welcome to another episode of the Sawdust and Fire Podcast. We are your hosts. I am Hunter Johnson.
And I'm Thomas Baldridge.
Hey, folks. We are joined back again this week with a very, very special guest here. The guy that is actually our producer that makes all this happen, or one of them anyway, Mr. Adam Keith. How are you, Adam?
I'm good, man. I'm good. How's it going down there in Arkansas?
Man, it's dry and it's been a little bit warm, and the deer aren't quite moving like we want them to. And we're trying to track a few deer and the conditions aren't good for tracking. But other than that, we're pretty happy. We're making it all right.
Oh, very good. Very good. You know, we got a little bit of rain up here this week, and, you know, mixed reviews. We're not sure if we got 2 inches, 3 inches, 3.5 inches, but my app says over 3 inches. Matt's rain gauge for some reason said 1.5 inches. And he's like, I don't believe it. I know we had more rain than that. So we're not real sure what happened, but we know we got a lot of rain. And I actually talked to a buddy of mine. Who better to talk to about how good the rain was than somebody who's digging holes all the time?
Absolutely.
And buddy of mine, he sets headstones. He owns a monument company, and they're digging and setting the headstones, and they dig them about 16-20 inches deep, and to put the gravel in. And he told me that all those August and July rains that we got didn't even get into the ground. It was still powder. Horrible. And he said this last rain we got soaked all the way through, and you go 16 inches deep and there was still water. So he's like, it was a good soaking rain.
Man, that's awesome. We have actually here at our place, we have had 3 rains in the last 4 months that each one was less than 0.5 inch.
It's been insane. Worse than 2012. It's the worst year I can remember in my adult life.
Terrible. I haven't planted any fall food plots yet, and not sure that I will at this point. We've got a pretty good chance of rain coming Saturday, and if we can get some moisture, I may do a little disking, swing some wheat and stuff out and kind of work it in a little bit. But if I don't get it, I'm not going to worry about it.
Yeah.
Leave it in the bag.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, plant it in the spring and call her good. Man, I tell you, It's been an interesting year. Praise the good Lord for a good acorn crop, because they didn't have acorns right now. I don't know what they'd be doing.
Man, I guess y'all's acorn crop is as good as ours. We have a bumper crop again this year.
All white oaks, no red oaks for us.
Really?
Hardly any. We had such a late frost last year that the red oaks didn't make any acorns, but the white oak sure did. And I'm telling you, we did this logging operation on a farm over the last couple of years, and we had little old white oaks that weren't but 6 inches DBH, and they were loaded as well. I mean, there is so many. Chainsaw Chad and I have been talking, we're like, there's going to be so many white oak sprouts coming up and all this opened up blue clear sky with the fire. There's going to be just a ton of oak saplings coming, which is great. We need some good white oak regeneration.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I'm glad you're on here. Do what?
And then comes the fire.
Right. Right. Now, will the fire hurt those little white oaks like that?
So we look at it like this. Historically, there was fire. We don't want to wait. You know, some research will say, you know, we don't want to burn right out of the gate. But at the same time, it's not like the good Lord was waiting for that next generation to burn up. They were just burning. Yeah. And I'd say the strongest and the ones that are in the little spots that are the fire's not as hot, then they probably survive. I look at it as a way as thinning out the weak and helping the strong.
Survival of the fittest, kind of.
That's right.
We might as well get them used to it from day one. Let's go ahead.
Day one.
There you go.
How do you learn to swim? You throw them in the water and see if they do it.
There you go. Hey, I'm glad you're joining me tonight, because I got a deal that I keep hearing a lot about. And I guess we'll title this podcast here, How to Eat an Elephant.
Yeah.
you know, they say one bite at a time.
Yeah. If we're going to phrase that, you know, the person I've heard say that the most comes from East Tennessee by the name of Mr. Craig Harper.
Yep.
And when he says it, it's always got that East Tennessee drawl on it. And it always cracks me up. Somebody says, how do you eat an elephant? And I think of him one bite at a time.
Oh, good stuff.
Yeah. How do you eat an elephant? It's exactly that. One bite at a time.
Well, I kind of referenced that because y'all are out here writing a lot of plans and prescriptions, and it seems like there might be a little bit of a disconnect with some. And how do I go about getting all of this done? Do I tackle it myself, by myself, in my free time? Do I try to get some cost share assistance? Do I get my buddies in here?
Mm-hmm.
You know, do you hire a contractor or do you not? Then how do you pay for it? You know, there's a lot of things, and it seems like a lot of times when we get other people involved, whether it's a contractor or a government entity that's going to help pay for stuff, sometimes they have a little different viewpoint than what the consultant we paid has. And wanted to kind of touch on some of that, how we go about. So you've came to, let's say you've come to my place and you've written me a plan, and it involves a lot of hack and squirt, a lot of invasive spraying, putting in fire lines, prescribed fire, edge feathering. Now I'm sitting here and I'm looking at your plan, and I can read the plan in about 30 or 45 minutes, but how do I get all this crap done?
Yeah, that is a really good question. You know, with how we work and the way we operate and write our plans specifically, we typically write a 5-10 year plan. And one of the most common questions I get regarding TSI from a landowner is, okay, I see the areas you want me to TSI, but there's other areas that you don't have anything on there. And I'm assuming you want me to do something with those at some point. And I'm like, not right now. You cannot overwhelm yourself. This is the classic analysis paralysis.
Right.
If you were to, let's think about Noah building the ark. You just think about, you know, he hadn't seen rain. They'd never seen rain. And God's telling him to build a boat. He's probably not seen many boats, if ever. And he's thinking the size of this thing. How did this man not go through analysis paralysis? I'm sure he did. And here we are thinking, okay, got this plan. I've got 200 acres and I've got 8 acres of temporary forest openings or micro clear cuts. I've got 40 acres of TSI. I've got old field management. I've got wildlife openings. I have water holes. I have a couple new food plots. I've got burning. I've got invasive treatment. I've got, you name it, in the wildlife management space, I've got a little bit on my land. And how do I even begin to tackle this? And a lot of it comes down to then I'm a dentist or I'm a surgeon or I'm a CPA. How do I accomplish this? And that's really what our business, we work with a lot of those people and then helping them try to understand how to implement it, what's the best use or best practice to implement it, and then what kind of timetable are we looking at? And, and then you get the other people involved and it can get complicated really, really quickly. So the analysis paralysis gets under the magnifying glass even more. And that's where you got to keep, for me, the best clients, the ones who see the best work and the best improvement are the ones who are in almost constant contact with me as they move from one project to the next, so whether it's using a contractor or doing it themselves, sending me pictures, getting the verbal or just getting the thumbs up emoji from me saying, good job. That's what you're supposed to do. I think a lot of times guys go out because you know, our message has always been a lot different than what has been preached for so many years about how to grow big deer or how to manage your farm for deer. I mean, a lot of times I think, not to toot my own horn or Matt's horn, but we basically, I think a lot of times when guys hear us talk TSI or using a chainsaw for the sake of a deer, it might be the first time they've ever heard that connection.
Right.
And so now we're trying to eliminate what a guy's been heard or been, he's been told for years, he's read for years, he's seen for years. And now we're supposed to make him expect him just to completely erase that, pivot 180 and go the direction of what we're trying to tell him. So there's a lot of variables or a lot of things that come in play that, that really cause a guy to go, pump the brakes. I have to sit and think about this for a while. Right. And I'm sure he probably went through it as well.
Oh yeah. Yeah, definitely. But to back up on something you said, so we hire you to come in and do this work and you write the plan and we pay you. You mean it's not over? You're still, we can still get a hold of you after that?
Yeah, that's that kind of what we do. I mean, some guys think that you can't, that it's just like, they're bugging me and I'm like, nope, that's what you paid me for. So, you know, when you hire me, shoot me an email.
Yep.
It does. I feel better about it when you're sending me emails once a month, telling me what's going on, or texting me. It's the, you know, if I was to take up golf again and I was going to get golf lessons, I wouldn't just go to an instructor one day, work through every club I got in the bag, and then step away and go play rounds of golf for the rest of my life. I'd like to check back in with that instructor. Even if it's just over the phone saying, you know, there's a little tweak in my swing or whatever, I'm doing this. And he's like, try this. You know, just the communication helps.
Right.
And for us, you know, our business has evolved. And we used to be, we've gotten really dialing in and trying to improve our deliverables to exceed what most people would probably expect consultant to provide, which would be a quick write-up, one map. We provide five maps in a lot of cases to try to break out TSI. Like, this is your map for chainsaw work. This is your map for fire. This is your map for tree stands based on wind direction. So when you're hunting, that's where you need to look. If the wind's out of the southeast, look for the stands that are okay for southeast. And let's say they're light blue, then find those stands and choose which one you like best. And then we have the one that kind of works through the timetable that basically is like, okay, these are the bedding thickets you do over the next 2 years. These are the bedding thickets you do year three, year four. This is the TSI to do year three, four. This is the TSI to do year six and seven. And just try to make it as simple as possible. But guess what? It's still not that simple.
Right, right. I can see that. It is a little more simple than what, you know, we've got a reservoir and we have a couple of different lake biologists. And I keep trying to get him to write me a long-term plan instead of just 1 year. And his response is always the same. No, we can't do that. Because everything's changing underwater. And what I tell you to do this year, you're not going to do it all. And I don't know what you're going to get done and what you're not. So I can't write you a plan for the next 10 years or next 5 years because you're not going to follow it to a T and your bait fish and everything is always changing. But fortunately, our timber is changing every day, but it's not changing enough that we can't, I mean, we can predict what's going to happen with that. So We can give a guy a plan and break it down, but I don't want people to be like me. You know, we've got a hack and squirt project for the next 10 years across 400 to 600 acres. So we need to be getting 40 to 60 acres a year. And we'll probably wait right there to close to the end of the 10 years and try to do it all at once.
That's usually how it works.
Right.
For a lot of people, and especially on the government program side, if you've entered into a forestry management plan and, you know, it's a, you know, typically I think based on my understanding of dealing with NRCS and a couple of practices, a forestry management plan is written for a 10 10-year period. And if you're looking for equip cost share opportunities, those are 3-year contracts. So basically you're going to do the forest management plan. Then you're going to take that and get approval for whatever work for the next 3 years. And then once you complete that, then you reapply for another contract that's 3 years. And then once you complete that, then you apply for another one that's 3 years. And then when you complete that, then you apply for the one for 1 year, and then you're done. And you think about land management here, and golly, that's a long time. It's really not. 10 years goes like that. Yep. And especially on your farm, when you're looking at it from a standpoint of, oh, I thinned the timber and now I'm getting close to a timber harvest, and move very quickly. And I can understand how you could get overwhelmed very quickly as a landowner from a different field of expertise moving into this field that is a moving target. I mean, it is ever changing and it is always curveballs being thrown at you. I can understand why landowners get overwhelmed. And that's where one of my biggest jobs is to put a hand around their back and on their shoulder and say, okay, deep breaths. It's yep. going to be okay.
Yep.
This is what we do for a living. And if we get thrown a big curveball, we sling a bigger curveball back. And we just try to move forward rather than move backwards.
So do you take that into consideration? Is that a conversation that's had on the front end before you write the plan? Are we going to pursue cost share? Do we have the means to pay a contractor, or are we going to try to do this ourselves along with buddies?
Always that conversation. What's the workload look like that we're going to be up against? Who's going to implement? What tools are available? What's the budget available? And try to figure out what's going to be the best practices moving forward. And for a lot of our landowners, when I was early on in consulting for Land and Legacy, you know, I consulted for years before that with another company. And as we launched Land and Legacy, it was kind of our first official of like, okay, this is ecosystem management. This is not deer management. This is not food plots. This is not feeders. This is, by golly, this is time to put our big boy pants on and get to it. And I was feeling very ambitious that, you know, you could inspire a landowner and still do get a landowner inspired to do this work. He wants to do all this work. Right. But over time, there's been this understanding of going, you know, when you look at a brand spanking new chainsaw sitting in the back of a UTV with an S-shaped bar, you think, there might have been a better way.
Right.
Maybe that landowner would have been better off just paying a contractor. Right. So as time has evolved, we've been able to establish contractors in various locations and say, these are the guys, these are their rates. And if you combine that with any kind of cost share or logging, let's say you log and you make some income, now pay a part of that income to these guys to TSI it after the logging. Now the forest is just leaps and bounds. We've knocked out in a year, 2 years, what would take you 15 most likely.
Right.
And then what's the value of that on your life? Because now you get to enjoy it, rather than knock it out 15 years later and have a bad hip and a bum back, and your kids are already moved out of the house. And so as time has progressed, I really try to open the conversation to have contractors on the job site more times than not.
Makes perfect sense. You know, one of the things, so I've been to a couple of different chainsaw classes over the years, and the first one, it was kind of mandatory I go to, and I was being a smart aleck. I said, y'all want me to teach it when I get there, or am I supposed to learn something from these guys, or what do y'all want? Because I had used a chainsaw, felt like I was probably pretty good with it. But, you know, I went to that chainsaw course and was shocked at how much I learned about how to do it more safely than what I had been doing, as well as be more efficient and proficient with the chainsaw and not let it wear me out. So once I kind of learned some of that and started doing, felt a little more comfortable jumping out and running a chainsaw a lot more than what I had in the past, a lot of people would be really shocked at how much work you can get done in an afternoon with a chainsaw on your own property.
No doubt.
It's everybody just looks at it as overwhelming, but especially two guys, you get a buddy to come help you, and man, y'all can knock a big dent in some stuff in one afternoon.
No doubt. Especially, I mean, chainsaw, great. But imagine a crew with hatchets and bottle herbicides doing late summer hack squirt.
Yes.
You know, mid-story thinning. My goodness, you can cover some ground. And that's where, you know, you said something that cracked me up, because I think back when I was working for the Missouri Department of Conservation in college, towards the end of my college, we were going to do some chainsawing, and they had to, air quote, officially train me before I could do it for legal purposes. There was, I don't know if it was official or not, but it was like, wow, I thought there was only one way to start a chainsaw. You grab the handle and you drop it and you yank the pull cord. Wow. I mean, that's how you start a chainsaw. And it was like, nope. Oh, this is a better way. It feels a little goofy at first, but by golly, I don't nick my pants anymore. Oh, chaps, you're supposed to wear chaps. And that little black thing on the front, that's not an extended handle. That's actually a brake.
Yeah. So, the first class I went to, the guy asked, did all of you drive here? Everybody have transportation? Everybody have a way to get home?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, we do. The first one I see drop start a chainsaw in this course, get in that vehicle and proceed home.
Yeah.
We're not doing that here.
Yeah. I think, you know, all those trainings that the government, a lot of those government agencies put out, prescribed fire training, chainsaw training, there's various courses for timber management, all these different things. Those are great places for landowners to learn general practices. To me, most of the times the ones I've been around are not real in-depth, but it can at least help prevent a guy from cutting his leg off, hopefully with a chainsaw, or burning his neighbor's pasture or timber up because of a prescribed fire. And I think that's where that's a good start. A good start for guys. It's really, to me, the whole focus of the podcast, what you wanted to talk about, is really trying to help and understand a landowner's ability, but also helping him get to his goals. And sometimes you have to walk on eggshells and try to work around feelings and understand that you're not the best. They're not the best man for the job, and we need to find other ways. And there are a lot of ways to do it.
Right.
There's a lot of ways to cook an elephant steak.
That's right. That's right. Some of them are really good, I would imagine, and some of them probably not very good.
Yeah, some of them are probably not very good, just like regular beef steaks.
So what percentage of your clients do you feel like do it on their own versus get cost share versus hire a contractor outright out of their own pocket?
Well, first I need to say that based on all the clients we work with, a lot of them implement a portion of the plan themselves.
Right.
And that's where 90% of our clients will implement the first few steps of the plan. And then life happens and some of them just aren't able to do it. Or some of them are like, yeah, because no matter how great of a plan I can write, no matter how great of a farm they have, if they're not a very good hunter, they blow it all. They mess it all up. So it doesn't matter. So like a lot of times, let me back up on that. A few times in my career, I've had a client, I've checked in with them and I said, hey, how's it going? How's the farm hunting now that you've done some work, or now that you've done a lot of the cuts and different things? And they're like, yeah, it's going all right. And I'm like, he's not telling me the whole story, what's going on. And come to find out that they just weren't seeing as many deer around certain habitat features as they thought they would. Okay, well, tell me what's going on. You thought the bedding thickets were going to be just amazing. Why aren't they? And then we have to start dissecting why. Well, you've got the cameras all around it. You're in there checking and pulling those cards constantly. No matter how good it is, if you can't abide by the rules of the bedding cut, staying away from them, staying out of them, not abusing them, then it's not going to be a bedding cut. It's simply a clear cut that has too much human disturbance. And so it's very hard for me to say, you know, like how many implement it themselves, because a lot of them implement a portion of it, mainly the bedding thickets, the new food plots, the new trails, whatever, on their own. It's the next steps that really start separating the really good clients who are seeing drastic changes and the clients that see some change but don't get the full value of it. And that's when you move into the TSI, the invasive control, the old field management, the wildlife openings, the prescribed burning. Those are the ones, when they start doing that, that's when I get the crazy photos and the phone calls where they're just over the moon excited of what's happening. It's probably still over 60% of our clients do the work themselves.
Okay. What about cost share versus out of pocket for their own pocket for contractors?
Probably 40% use government cost share.
Really? Okay.
Probably less than that. The more I think about it and I crunch the numbers, I bet it's less than that. Just for the simple fact, it's not about money for most of them. It's more about government paperwork, requirements, deadlines, and everything that makes the government so wonderful.
Well, so of those guys that try to get government assistance, how often do you see someone else getting involved and wanting to change the plan up that y'all have written?
9 out of 10 times.
Really? And what do you say to the landowner in a case like that when he calls you up and says, hey, I paid y'all to come out, y'all wrote me this plan, but I had Mr. So-and-so out from the whatever the other day, and he says I ought to do this and this and this, and he didn't like some of that.
It's usually a sarcastic, smart aleck comment, usually, like, I didn't realize he was killing big as deer as me. Or as frequent. I didn't realize his farm had as many turkeys as mine. Something like that. Usually I'm like, okay, and I try to be nice about it. Like, what do they see differently? Maybe, you know, shoot holes in my plan. Let's talk about this. What is it? And really the biggest problem that I see, and I have a lot of good friends. I have a lot of listeners on the podcast that are government employees. So I don't have this, I don't have this big opinion of government employees, especially natural resources, that say they're all bad. Not at all.
Oh, for sure.
Just seems like a lot with don't quite have the same goals as me. And a lot of times I can give you some examples. I had a landowner one time that wanted to plant pollinators. He wanted kind of have an emphasis on quail in certain portions of his farm. I was trying to look at different things to do. His wife liked flowers and the aesthetics of meadows and stuff. So try to send him into a pollinator planting. The NRCS guy tried to discourage him from that and just try to plant some strips of Milo and millet and sunflowers out in his field and not really do any pollinator planting. And as I stated with him, I'm like, that really makes not a lot of sense to me, because you said you didn't want to plant this every year. Those are annuals. You're going to have to plant them every single year. You're going to have to buy the seed. You're going to have to, and then a lot of times they may fail. And so it's like, why can't we do pollinator? And I don't know. It was just one of those where it's like, maybe this isn't like guy. The landowner ended up doing it without him, just went ahead and bought pollinators out of pocket and planted them. I think the biggest hurdles that a lot of landowners face when I work with them and trying to implement cost share is trying to take my plan and turn it into a government application plan, an EQIP application. And that's where it's like, because I'm talking bedding thickets, they're talking temporary forest openings. In bedding thickets, I like some hinge cuts. In temporary forest openings, you can't have hinge cuts. It's all flush cut. You're basically restarting the forest. Well, I'm not opposed to it at all. I even did temporary forest openings on mine. But getting the NRCS person or whoever the person is to understand that we want to clear cut this area because it's garbage timber is, and that person likes trees, they're probably not. They probably don't like that. So then they try to veer them off and do something else, like just general TSI. And that's where a lot of times it's just confusion. It's back and forth trying to understand each other, what the goals are, and simply stating when I meet with landowner, he tells me his goals and I say, this is how we're going to get there. When they meet with the NRCS or a government agent and they say, these are my goals, they try to use the programs to help get them their goals. And not all the programs are out there to help them get their goals, because there aren't hinge cut pockets, or there's not these temporary forest openings, or they're not, I'm not telling them to get aggressive. And like, for example, a lot of TSI programs don't allow softwood tree removal, softwood berry trees, flowering dog, sassafras, black haw, all those can't be killed. Well, here in the Ozark Mountains where I'm at, flowering dogwood is a problem. I mean, it is filling understories, and we got to kill them, some of them anyway. And it's hard to get a government employee who has a forestry focus bias to put that aside to help a wildlife focused landowner. That's right. Probably when there's issues in trying to work with the government, that's 90% of the time. That's what it is. Personal bias of whatever it may be.
Gotcha. What do you see? A lot of people want timber for the future, timber harvest, timber value for some supplemental income there. And some people just want a pure wildlife focus. And the people that you deal with, what percentage do you think, how do you think that lies in there? I mean, obviously we all want money, but how many of them are hung up on timber production to the point that it impedes with their wildlife goals?
Very, very few let timber value and future timber affect their wildlife that I work with. I know those landowners are out there, but they're not my client. My client generally will say, I don't care about the timber value. If you tell me to clear cut this whole thing, I will. Even Great. If it's near white oak. I mean, they don't care. They're, by golly, we're going to see wildlife come back, come hell or high water type mentality. So that's what my clients tend to think, and praise the Lord that they're that way, because we can get a lot of stuff done.
That's really what I suspected. I really suspected by the time they had picked up the phone to call Land and Legacy, they were 100% wildlife goal oriented.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of like they're not partially committed in this. By the time 95% of the people that have called to hire, they're 95%. I mean, they are committed. And then when we get there and we start talking the plan and get the vision for it, they're diving neck deep in. And the biggest hurdle is how to get there. And I'll give you an example. I'm seeing a change in clients that I work with go from and thankful for this because we're getting to see some really cool projects get completed a lot quicker than had they done it themselves. But the contract crew that I work with that we use is, you know, relatively affordable compared to what most people would think. And now it's, if you've never priced out TSI and you get a quote for $235 an acre, you're like, whoa. But that's some serious work. And I've seen some major changes happen for landowners. And, you know, stage that out. If let's just go for an example here. If we do TSI, we get involved in a TSI project, and the cost share is $220 an acre or whatever, $180 an acre, and they get, you know, a 3-year plan, and it's 50 acres here, 50 acres there, 50 acres there. And we bring in the contract crew and they're $235. Well, then you're looking at, what is that, $55 an acre that you have to pay out of pocket. But you can look at that saying, now we're going to get some, we're that much closer to a timber harvest now that these trees are more healthy. And by the way, I have phenomenal habitat through there. So I'm basically paying $55 an acre when I'm paying $300 an acre in food plots and they failed because of the drought. You know, you can start adding this up and say, yeah, this is really a good practice here. And because of that TSI crew, they can knock it out in a week, which I've seen it happen on many projects. They're done and it's a 3-year contract. Okay. But there's no penalty to complete it early. So they just do it all at one fell swoop, 150 acres done, paid out the door. They paid him. They paid their out-of-pocket expense, and it's good riddance. We're moving on down the road to happy, healthy habitat. And I'm seeing landowners do that more and more now that we have this good contract crew in place. And a short story, I have a client in Illinois, West Illinois, right there in the Golden Triangle. I told him, I said, I got a contract crew for you, because he lives out of state. And he's like, I really want you to handle all of it. And I'm like, well, so you want all the work? Yep, all the work, all the burning, everything done except food plots, because I got a crop farmer that does those for me. Okay, so we sent them in, contract crew. They clear cut / bedding thicket creation on 8 to 10 acres, and then they TSI'd 35 acres. And now keep in mind, this is Illinois, so it's just like little blocks here and there. Right. It's not TSI'ing the whole timber. It's TSI in these little pockets around the bedding thickets, these little knolls, these little ridge tops, where they're going to get the most light, the quickest response. It's going to motivate the landowner to say, I want more of that. And but get the biggest, I mean, it's the low hanging fruit. And they did all that. And he said, just do it all. They knocked it out in like 5 days. That was in August of this year. And in mid-October, he texted me and said, this is the craziest year I've had for bucks on camera. Like, they're sticking.
Yes.
And we're seeing more deer than we've ever, more good bucks than we've ever seen. And it's like, dude, you did that in August. Imagine what it's going to look like when you get a couple of burns in, you get a couple of growing seasons in. It's going to be sticking. And it's like that just... I have more clients that I worked with in the past that were planning on doing it themselves. They didn't get to it. Now they're like, bring the contract crew. And so I'm seeing this kind of shift where they're all like, you know, I got the bedding cuts done, but I still got TSI to do. So bring them in.
Right. Right. The property that I live on is primarily a duck club first and for deer second. We don't have turkey or quail, and there's not anywhere near us, but so we're not really focused on that here. But so 20 years ago, the previous landowner had a consultant come in, a bottomland hardwood waterfowl consultant come in and do a plan and prescription for him. And he started out really well. He'd done some timber thinning, he cut a lot of overcups, a lot of ash out of the place, and then he replanted some red oaks in some areas, but he dropped the ball on his TSI work and a lot of the other things he was going to do on this property and just kind of just stopped. And, you know, I come here 15 years after that and or 10 years after that, and it's just a growed up jungle mess that, you know, he started his plan and then just quit. Do you see that very often? Do you see people start a program and then just kind of quit on it for whatever reason?
Yeah, I do. And I think a lot of it comes down to they saw results and they felt like they'd met their goals because they got to where they wanted. For example, let's just say that they are in an area that a mature buck is typically like they kill the neighborhood buck that everyone's chasing is 140. And they just wanted to be able to really start killing those deer rather than seeing them get killed by the neighbor. All of a sudden they've killed a 140-ish buck a couple of years in a row and they back off on the habitat because they felt like they got there.
Right.
That's what I see more of. Not necessarily, or, you know, life happens. They have kids that get involved in gymnastics. They have kids that get involved in basketball and all of a sudden they're busy year round and they can't do it. I see that a good bit, which is you're a dad first before your habitat manager. So that's just part of it, but that's where a contract crew can be pretty valuable.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I really think that's what happened here in this case. And, you know, that is really easy to do. You know, in previous podcasts, I've talked about some of the work that I've done, just spending 2 hours with a hatchet and a squirt bottle or 2 hours with a chainsaw at the end of the day, throughout the spring and early summer. And we see results pretty quick from that. And it would be real easy to do part of the prescription and think, oh man, I've made strides here, and then just completely stop or drop the ball. And the next thing you know, from lack of maintenance, you've went the wrong way. And now we've got all of this unwanted stuff growing up that we've, you know, pretty much got to start over, whether it's, you know, we didn't burn like we should, or we didn't, spray stumps, or we didn't complete something. So,
yeah, we sent our reports and our full man plan. There's a line that says along these lines, I'll just ask you, what do you think invasive species, what kind of, if you were to poll 100 invasive species, let's play Family Feud here. If you were to poll 100, we polled 100 invasive species and asked them what their favorite type of landowner is, what would they say? And a complacent landowner that does nothing, that's just lets it sit idle, or one that's very aggressive? They love the very aggressive one, the one that cuts the timber, sends hot fire through there, then gets busy and doesn't return, because that's where the invasives go nuts. So you kind of have a big responsibility. If you're logging, you're doing aggressive practices, you better see it through, or it's going to be worse than your neighbor who's just sitting idly by, letting timber mature, as I say in air quotes.
Right. That's absolutely correct. And I've seen that several times in the things that I've done. Of course, you know, what I'm doing is just completely overwhelming, being by myself and so much property that needs so much work. But we're making dents. You know, we're constantly improving some things. And then, you know, it's kind of like I compare it to this. There's Highway 67 that runs from Little Rock up to Missouri, Poplar Bluff, Missouri area. And they started that when I was a baby, and they'd made it to Searcy, Arkansas. And now here I am 50 years old and they're still not done with it. But what they had started with is falling completely apart. They're having to go back and fix it before they can even finish. And so we get into that trap sometimes too.
No doubt.
A lot of things. So,
yeah, that's something my brother and I are kind of facing a little bit with limited time, limited schedules. But trying to make a big impact is like, man, sometimes we feel like, you know, we're utilizing some government cost share, and it's like, here's the deadline. And you're like, oh, take a big gulp. We got to get this done. And it seems like a lot, but then at the same time, we're trying to get it to the point where at the very least we can get the contract crew in there to do it. So, it's just, it's one of those things that you gotta see it through, or you're taking one step forward to take three steps back.
Man, I say all the time, if I could ever get through the project phase and get through to a maintenance phase, life is going to be so much better. And every year I say, boy,
it's close. It ain't possible.
Yeah. It's not possible. You don't get there.
It is. It is. I have a couple clients that, you know, the bedding thickets were done. The TSI is done for the most part. The only places that aren't TSI are like riparian areas and little gullies, areas that were like, that's supposed to be closed canopy anyway. That's an area that's a dense forest. And they've got all the roads in. They've got all the food plots done. All they really do is plant food plots, burn, and treat invasives. And those guys are like, they live the dream life where you're like,
that'd be an awesome world to live in.
But it took a grind to get there.
Right.
And, but at the same time, that's not forever, because at some point the timber is going to mature and be ready for harvest.
Right.
And then you harvest, then you're back to TSI, and then you're back to maybe planting some more trees or whatever it may be. But there is a time that you think, okay, spend more time on a tractor than I do anything else. And I have a landowner. Man, he's one of my favorite stories to tell. But him and his dad have this place, very odd-shaped farm. One that is not ideal, that you don't like, more like a long rectangle, like I have to name that game where you drop in the up and down, but I draw a little spaces down. It's one of those where it's like it's long, skinny, opens up, gets a little bigger. You're like, okay, it's not ideal, but oh, we also live an hour away or a good ways away. We can't be here all the time. We don't want to be here all the time because I have a family with a bunch of young kids. Okay. But all right. Now we just, with each thing, it gets a little more difficult to reach the full potential. But what is the full potential for this landowner? Harvesting good deer for the neighborhood consistently and having lots of fun hunts where I see deer, I see turkeys, I feel like I'm making a difference and I'm improving my land. We get there and he's going to kind of take his ease into it. He doesn't want to get crazy. Okay. So we look at it. Hey, you don't have dense cover. You have some glades. You have a lot of TSI to do. You have these big fields of fescue that you're not wanting to hay anymore because you weren't making anything from it. And they were cutting it for hay just to clean it up. He starts spraying everything, letting the natives just grow up wild. He cut in bedding thickets. He did some cost share, did the glade restoration. He put in fire lines through cost share. He starts burning. Now his maintenance is really burning and treating invasives. But because he doesn't have food plots, he doesn't have plant food plots in the spring or in the fall. And he kills a good deer almost every single year, downwind of a bedding cut. His brother or his dad kills a good deer, sees good deer, and they are loving life. And it's a small, less than 200-acre farm in the Ozarks. And it's just like a great story because he'll send a picture and here's a really nice buck that everybody's like, my goodness, that guy's got it going on. And he ain't even doing food plots. And he's just living his best life with his family. But by golly, he has a great farm.
Yeah.
And it's so awesome.
We are really thankful for the work that we've done for this year because, you know, I've mentioned earlier, I haven't got any fall food plots planted yet. And even the guys that have, they've drought stricken or they didn't grow, they didn't sprout, didn't germinate. And it's been absolutely horrible. And the same way back in the spring, it stayed so wet here in the spring, nobody got anything planted. For spring food plots, even the farmers around us, this is big ag country, and no one around us got soybeans planted till June or July. So, you know, the natives that we've had, the natural forage and vegetation we've had growing on our properties has been huge this year.
Yep. Yep. We were just right before we did this podcast, Chad and I were sitting here looking at some pictures, and we have a food plot. You know, we didn't spray an ounce of herbicide on our food plots this year, other than atrazine when I was doing some switchgrass screens back in March. I think that's the only herbicide I used. And so we have a lot of weeds and who cares?
Yes.
One of our food plots has got black-eyed Susans, of course, you know, this time of year, those black-eyed Susans, they've reseeded and they're starting to grow back, little rosettes. And I mean, they're like 6-inch leaves, green, deer eating them, loving them. And you're like, I'm so thankful we didn't spread the flocks because there'd be nothing out here then. Yep. We'd kill all the weeds and those to survive the drought.
That's right.
And so we were looking at a couple of the trail cam photos, and there's an acre and a half food plot behind the deer. The same one where it's got all the black-eyed Susans and everything in it. There's something, and we can't tell what it is in the video. There's some sort of native vegetation right on the edge of the food plot that deer are just eating as they work that edge. And we're like, you know, it's October. What is the native vegetation that they're eating? And so we're going to have to go up there tomorrow probably and look at it and say, whatever that is, let's get more of it. And just because, my goodness, it's amazing.
Yeah, and that's what where most of my deer, you know, all of our kill plots, we didn't get a spring plot planted. We haven't got a fall plot planted. And we had Stratton's Legacy blend planted in them last fall and just let it go fallow all year. So there's a lot of natives coming up. You know, most of them are annuals, but they're coming up in in that mix. And it's been as good as if we would have got a food plot planted there.
Yeah. Yeah. No doubt. Hey, another thing we did this year, that just like we spilled, I had leftover rasps from last fall that we threw in our spring plant this year, and we planted late. It was late May. We spilled some of those in the gravel, creek gravel driveway of the cabin. And if it wasn't for the cows, I bet you they would have been 20 inches tall, green. They grew all summer long in the drought in gravel. And I just laugh when people say, got to have good seed soil contact. I'm like, they're not even soil there. It's gravel.
It's gravel. Yep. Well, it grows gravel. Pretty good in the floorboard of my side by side and the bed of my truck, both. So,
yeah. And so find those I mean, those are non natives, those brassicas, but the natives are more tough than the brassicas. And my goodness, you find the right ones and you can provide everything they need, even in terrible conditions.
Thomas has got a native grazing project he's working on, and the native grasses have got several forbs mixed in with them, and the big blue stem is overhead high. And
what year is he in that planting?
Second
year two? Yeah, year two.
Yep. And it's just phenomenal, the deer use. You know, it's the only thing that's been green all year long. I mean, all summer, yeah. It's we've been so drought stricken. It's the only thing he's had that's been green. And, you know, you look at the neighbor's pasture that's fescuing Bermuda grass, it just burnt completely up. And here the natives look good, and it's plumb full of deer and turkey and quail. And it's just, it's been awesome.
Yeah, I believe it. I believe it. For you know, just understanding the best for a lot of landowners. You know, we're talking plants, understand the best plants for your site. It's understanding the best practices for your project and understanding the best person to implement that for the project. And, you know, for me personally, I enjoy the work. It's the time part that doesn't allow it.
Right.
Every time we're doing something, I look at a way of saying, well, I wonder how we could do this ourselves and not have to hire it out. But there are things we have to hire out if we really want to reach those goals. And so with the landowners that we work with, I'm seeing kind of a transition. They do a lot of the work, like the bedding cuts. Those are easy, you know, go and do bedding cuts, temporary forest openings, go and do edge feathering because that's fun. That's a quick, easy way to see change. But hire out the TSI, or hire out the invasive control, or spraying out the fields of cool season grass. Let the local farmers come out and spray it.
Right, right. Yeah, makes perfect sense. So when y'all lay out a plan and you're breaking it down year by year, what they need to do, are you breaking out priorities? You know, let's do the bedding thickets first. Let's do the edge feathering next. Let's get the TSI done after that. Are you breaking it down like that based on?
Absolutely. Yeah. Okay. You want to do the low hanging fruit. Like You want to think about the hardest work that's going to take the least, the hardest work that will not show the drastic change. Those go last, because if those went first, there's easier chance of burnout. Yes. So you do the things that inspire you. And time again, what I say inspires most landowners is seeing daylight bucks on the property. That gets them going, okay, this is different. Yeah. This is different than I've ever experienced. And a lot of times that missing factor is dense cover. So therefore we do bedding thickets first. We improve food plots at the same time because they like them and they're not going on at the same time. And then you're looking at some edge feathering, possibly some TSI on south slopes, probably neck, maybe slope, not as much on the north and east slopes because they're a little bit more going to be more of a forest, going to be less sunlight, more moisture, probably more brambles and trees, saplings and grasses and forbs that are showy on a south slope. So we typically lay it out in a way that, you know, you see change.
I don't understand, and I've made this comment several times, I don't understand why more people don't get on board with all of this. You know, when you hire a, you know, if you're a business owner, and a lot of people can relate to this, when you're a business owner, hiring a perfect employee doesn't cost you a dime. They make you money. Yeah. The same way with hiring a consultant to come out and look at your property, it is saving you so much time and so much money and so much heartache in the long run. You can see success so much faster. It's not really costing you money. It's your money ahead if you hire a contractor or hire a consultant up front to lay you out a perfect plan. You get things like the big talk here for the last few weeks has been the October lull, and it's just going to be a couple of weeks. We're going to start talking about the lockdown phase. Everybody's going to be talking about that. And we've talked about drought. But when we've got natives and we've done some of this work, we don't have October lulls and we don't have lockdown phases where the deer, we don't see any deer and we don't have issues with the, we don't care that we don't get our food plots planted a lot of times.
No doubt. You don't care. And, you know, let's do a corny analogy here, but it's a lot like as a Christian and believe in who's in control, no matter how the economy is, no matter how bad the everything looks. Yeah. I'm not that down because I know who's in control and I know it's all going to be all right.
That's right.
And so you look at the landscape and say, well, I know that I'm following his template and I know what I've educated myself on what's needed for these wildlife and what's needed on landscape. So even in a drought, I know it's just a phase. We'll get through it. It will rain at some point and it will stop snowing at some point. It will stop raining at some point. It will get better. And so that's why it's just like, as landowners who have implemented and have started really looking at ecosystem management and have seen the diversity and added the change on the property, we just kind of back say, yeah, it's all going to be okay because I did it. And there is no such thing as an October lull. It may be on your property, but not on mine because right. I got the dense cover and I got the habitat. And frankly, it's phenomenal over here all fall. Even in a lockdown phase, I like lockdown phase because you just get tight to the bedding and know that they're in there. It's just a matter of time before they come out. And all that stuff is just like a guy once told me, you can ignore talk and you can ignore ego and you can ignore all these different things in life. But it's very hard for someone to ignore success.
That's right. That's right.
And so when you start having success on a farm and frankly, the big deer or the turkey pictures and the neighbor who's always killing the deer, you can sit there and call it luck for so long, for as long as you want. But at some point it starts to nag at you and figure out what he's doing. And that's where guys, landowners who have done the work, implemented the plan, contract crews, seen the change. That's who that they get the enjoyment. It's like, you know, not to sit on a soapbox too much longer, but we all wanted to be the best sports player. And I think of like Michael Jordan and Kobe Bryant. You think, well, I want to be the best at what I do. But they did things when other people were sitting at home, not practicing.
That's right.
And so good farm managers that are killing deer, that the best deer in the neighborhood, they're not sitting on TV watching hunting shows with cabin fever. They're out running chainsaw, running prescribed fire. They're killing their deer in January, February, and March. They're just going to get to put their hands on them in November and October.
That's right. That's right. That's a good phrase. You know, I say that often. Today I'll do what you want, so tomorrow I can do what you can't.
So, yeah, exactly.
Well, yeah. I think we'll leave everybody with that. I think this has been a pretty good podcast. You know, an analogy used a while ago somewhat is, you know, if you want your habitat, you want your wildlife to be everything that it can be, you follow the words of your consultant. For everything in life, else in life, you follow the words written in red.
There you go. Perfect.
So hope y'all have a great rest of the week, and y'all get out there and do a little doe harvest, do a little herd management, and maybe that old big buck will walk by. Until next week, we'll see y'all on the Sawdust and Fire podcast.